The utter desolation of the scene began to have its effect. I sat down to face the situation, and if possible, recall to mind some landmark which might aid me in extricating myself from my present position. If I could only find the ocean again, all would be clear, for I knew one could see the island of Groy from the cliffs. I laid down my gun, and kneeling behind a rock, lighted a pipe. Then I looked at my watch. It was nearly 4 o'clock. I might have wandered far from Kerselec since daybreak. Standing the day before on the cliffs below Kerselec with Gulven, looking out over the somber moors among which I had now lost my way, these downs had appeared to me level as a meadow, stretching to the horizon. And although I knew how deceptive is distance, I could not realize what from Kerselec seemed to be mere grassy hollows were great valleys covered with gorse and heather, and what looked like scattered boulders were in reality enormous cliffs of granite.
HPPodcraft.com.
Yet another protagonist goes out on the moors hunting and thinks, I don't need a guide. How could I possibly get lost?
It's Robert Chambers, the King in Yellow, all month as we continue our coverage on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chris Lang.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're here at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon.
This week, we're covering the story, The Demoiselle Dees. This is the fifth story in the collection, The King in Yellow, and I enjoyed it.
We kicked off the month with The Court of the Dragon and special guest Robin D. Laws, which was incredible, I think. Oh. So nice to have somebody smart on the show.
For once.
For once. Coming up, we're going to be joined by the equally smart and informed Kenneth Haidt, covering The Mask and Street of the Four Winds, also from The King in Yellow. For this story, however, you just have the two of us. It's going to be much more intimate this week, which is appropriate for a story with such a sexy French title.
Ooh la la. There's a lot of French in this story, and I just want to apologize up front.
Yeah, we have a hard enough time with the English language, but you know who doesn't? It's our reader. Once again, Mr. Wyatt S. Gray.
Woohoo!
He is very adept at the English language. Stand-up comic, voice actor, man of the people.
Yes.
Check him out at wyattcomedy.com. We'll link out to that in our show notes, and we are very glad to have him back once again. Thanks so much, Wyatt.
So glad. Now, before we get into the story, we have an epigraph and a quote. The epigraph is in French and translates to, "But I believe that I have descended into the well of shadows where Heraclitus said the truth is hidden." Heraclitus was a Greek philosopher who believed in the primacy of change. No man could step in the same river twice. And the inherent unity of opposites. The path up and the path down are one and the same. So this quote is from the third book of Pantagruel, which came out in 1546 by François Rabelais.
Heraclitus was known as the obscure, even in his time, because there were so many contradictions in his philosophy. What I believe overall he was saying in terms of the primacy of change is just that the one thing that's constant is change. Hmm. You hear that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, if you step in the same river twice, the river's going to be different. You're going to be different that second time. So
yeah.
Things are always changing. And in terms of the unity of opposites, I believe that's the tension in concepts. You know, things that can't exist without the other. Immortality makes no sense unless you have mortality, etc.
Right.
And I believe this quote is included not because of either of those notions, but because it has something to do with revelation about the true nature of things.
Then we get the quote, which is from Proverbs 30, 18 to 19. "There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, for which I know not. The way of the eagle in the air, the way of the serpent upon the rock, the way of the ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid." Now, maid can be translated into the French as demoiselle.
And I believe this quote is pulled in reference to the mystery of love. You know,
yes.
How does this even happen? Agur, who is the one saying this in the Bible, I believe is saying, "I don't know, and I don't think I'll ever understand those first three. It's all incomprehensible. A bird flies through the air without falling. That makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
A serpent somehow can move across a rock. It doesn't have any legs, so how's it doing that? And a ship is floating on the water, sailing across the seas. It never gets submerged in that water."
Mm-hmm.
So the fourth, I'm not sure if it's too wonderful for me, but I don't have access to it yet, so I'm not really sure. But men do crazy things for maids, and it's hard to understand why. You know, all these things there's a scientific basis for, but just observing them, it's hard to figure out how they work.
Yeah.
And I think this is a cool epigraph because love is mysterious. You know, there probably is, like I say, some kind of scientific basis behind love. You know, there's a reason we react the way we do to other people. There's a chemical basis for it, a biological basis for it. But on the surface, it is magic, mystery. Doesn't matter how skeptical you are or how in tune with underlying science you are, you can just fall in love with somebody when you meet them.
Sure.
Also, the first three things leave no trace. When the hawk flies through the air, there's nothing behind him to let you know that he did it. Same with the snake and the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the story goes, is there a trace when somebody falls in love? I think that that's posited as well.
Yeah.
Perhaps the story will tell us whether there is or not. According to the epigraphs, we're going to find some truth in the shadowy well of love, so let's get into it.
Our story begins with an American in France, Philip, who's lost his way on the moors of Brittany. He's wandered out of Courcelec, which is a manor house in Brittany, to do some hunting without the aid of a guide, despite the fact that he was told he needed a guide.
Yeah, it's annoying that Philip did this, but it does make him an active protagonist. I think it's essential. You know, we often make fun of our protagonists for doing stupid things like this, but so many horror or weird tales are kind of passive. You know, it's forces acting upon a person.
Right.
So it's important, I think, as a reader to get hooked in that the protagonist has done something to get themselves into the situation.
Mm-hmm.
If he's abiding by the rules and he gets assaulted by unknown forces, it's not as engaging as if he made some mistake and we as a reader go, uh-oh, you shouldn't have gone out without a guide. Let's see what happens to this guy now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a hook.
Chambers spent some time in France doing some studying in Paris, so he knows France. Mm-hmm. Finistère, the northwest part of Brittany, is where a lot of artists went, American and otherwise, to paint in the late 19th century.
Yeah, I found a little background on this setting and also the story at oldstyletales.com, the classic horror blog. It's a really cool site. I'll link out to it. This is a look at the story from M. Grant Kellermeyer, who writes, "Like New York and Paris, Brittany seemed to always inspire Chambers with its history and culture. Brittany is a vast horn of land that juts into the Atlantic from France's northwest corner. The people there are culturally Celtic, sharing more with the music, language, folklore, and customs of Wales, Ireland, and Scotland than with France proper. They speak a Celtic language, Breton, play music that harkens to the hills of Ireland, and have a rich folklore of fairies, ghosts, and sunken castles." One of the Breton legends, this is really interesting, I didn't know this, one of the Breton legends that fascinated Chambers was the story of the city of Ys, a mythical metropolis that was built below sea level on the coast, where the sea was held back by towering dikes. Like Atlantis, Sodom, and less mythically Pompeii, Ys was known for its decadence and for its catastrophic destruction. The legend said that Ys was at one time the preeminent city in all of Europe, but became the site of violent orgies organized by the king's daughter, Dahut, who was infamous for killing the men she slept with the morning after their drunken revels. One night during a terrible storm, Dahut bedded a knight dressed in red who tempted her to steal the key to the floodgates, secreted on her father's person, handing it to her new lover as a gift. The knight turned out to be Satan himself, and he unlocked the gates, letting the pounding seas swallow Ys, which is said to still be intact under the water, where Dahut remains enthroned a wicked mermaid. While Chambers' tale has little to do with the actual myth of Ys, the themes of both stories are consistent. Lost innocence, broken hearts, impossible love, wrenching pathos, and mystical sublimity. So, that's some background and what we have to look forward to as Philip wanders around the moors of Brittany, lost, not a house or even a tree in sight.
The day is getting long and the sky dark, so Philip thinks that he's going to have to hunker down for the night. Just then, some big bird flies into his face and then it shoots off into some brush. He hears the struggle and then it's all quiet. Goes over to check it out, and it's a falcon on the body of a dead rabbit. It's taken a bit of the meat and it's eating it. Philip notices that there are straps and a little bell on the bird. It's a falconing falcon. The bird belongs to someone.
And if you stopped reading right here, you could pretend that this is a story about Dar the Beastmaster. I'm not telling you to do that. I'm just saying that you have some options with this one.
They say the name of many birds. I don't know if it's this bird exactly. But I'm guessing Shirok is this bird's name.
Probably, yeah.
Just then, a woman shows up, pays little mind to Philip. She scoops up the bird and deftly places a hood on its head.
When he first sees her, he describes her as a girl, so I think she's pretty young.
She goes to pass him again, and he doffs his cap to her. She stops and looks at him, and she's lovely. He explains that he's lost, and she can't believe that he came all the way from Courcelec. And he says he's an American, and he was out there just to do a little hunting. He notices her accent is odd, and there's no hint of Britain in it, but he can't quite place it either. She says, "If you should walk all night, you could not reach Courcelec now, even if you had a guide. This was pleasant news." He's already thinking, "Oh, hello.
Yeah.
This is going to be some sexy romance kind of thing." So ribald.
"An American," she says. "I have never before seen an American," which is what her accent sounds like. It's very hard to play. But this kind of thing must happen to you all the time, Chris.
What?
When you introduce yourself as an American. "An American, I've never before seen an American."
Oh,
doesn't that happen up there?
No, no. But everybody tells me about their trips to Florida. That's what always
that's
happens.
Right.
That's what always
Florida,
happens.
Florida, that's right.
She says to...
The best example of America.
The best example. He plays it cool, and he asks if there's some local peasant hut that I can stay at. you know, hoping that she's going to say, you come stay with me. You know, he's playing that game. Yeah. And she says, no, there's no peasants around here. And he asks for directions back to Kersilek, but she says, to come is easy and takes hours. To go is different. It may take centuries.
Ooh. And I already thought, okay, so this is some kind of mystical place he's visiting, possibly out of time. Mm-hmm. You know, Lovecraft's written these kinds of stories. Robert E. Howard's written these kinds of stories. The accidental time travel usually does involve some kind of Celtic mythology or something like that. Sure. But I liked the description conceptually as well, how many things are actually like this, where it's easy to jump in, but it's much more difficult to extricate yourself. Sure. Like, I ordered one bottle of shampoo from an infomercial, and now they're charging me every week for stuff I don't want on a subscription rate, and I got to spend a day and a half on the phone getting it all canceled. And I think a lot of love stories can end up like this as well. They're really hot and heavy at first. You know, we met, we moved in together in 2 weeks, we were married a month later, and then it didn't work out, and the divorce took 2 years. You know, so sure. I like this idea that love is easy to get into, but it can take centuries to get out of.
That's true for a lot of things as well, because if you think of like a vase, it's really easy to just push a vase over and break it. But trying to put it together, that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Like many things, it's easy to get into and sometimes really difficult to get out, if you ever can.
I mean, I think she's referring to some kind of time tunnel, but metaphorically, I thought it was a cool concept. Now, this beautiful young woman, after saying this, she blows a whistle as if summoning some other folks.
She asks Philip to sit on the rock and rest until her guys show up.
They are very beautiful, these moors, she said quietly. Beautiful, but cruel to strangers, I answered. Beautiful and cruel, she repeated dreamily. Beautiful and cruel. Like a woman, I said stupidly. Oh, she cried with a little catch in her breath and looked at me. Her dark eyes met mine, and I thought she seemed angry or frightened. Like a woman, she repeated under her breath. How cruel to say so. Then, after a pause, as though speaking aloud to herself, how cruel for him to say that. I don't know what sort of apology I offered for my inane, though harmless, speech, but I know that she seemed so troubled about it that I began to think I had said something very dreadful without knowing it. And I remembered with horror the pitfalls and snares which the French language sets for foreigners. While I was trying to imagine what I might have said, a sound of voices came across the moor, and the girl rose to her feet. No, she said, with a trace of a smile on her pale face. I will not accept your apologies, monsieur, but I must prove you wrong. And that shall be my revenge. Look, here come Haster and Raoul.
Haster? Alas, Haster did not mean what it means now at the time. Right. And I'm sure we've talked about this before, but Haster comes from Ambrose Bierce.
As does Carcosa, which is used throughout The King in Yellow, a few things.
Haster was introduced in Haida the Shepherd as the god of shepherds. Haster was the god of shepherds. We get Lovecraft's take on this, most likely from when Bierce writes, Haster, who never disclosed himself, or as Lovecraft spun it, he who is not to be named.
And we've covered those Bierce stories, Haida the Shepherd. We've talked about Haster a lot on those, as well as the Lovecraft episodes and the other chamber stuff we've done. As we referenced last week, we've covered Repair of Reputations as well as the Yellow Sign. And in Repair of Reputations, Haster is a place. Haster is mentioned in the Yellow Sign without explanation, so I don't know if it's a person or a place in that example.
Yeah.
This story is a little different than those we've covered so far in The King in Yellow, though, as it has no real overt connection to The King in Yellow. The play is never mentioned, except for this reference here to Haster and a little pun we get later. And we never discover much about this Haster, if he was named after something or some place, or if this is the original Haster, if this is the King of Shepherds. All we know is he's a good hunter. He's buddies with the Demoiselle Dis. That's all we know. That's all we're ever going
to
know.
She introduces the men to Philip, and they don't say anything. The woman wants to prove him wrong, so she invites him for hospitality at her home. Yeah, that was his plan all along. That's what he's hoping for. She asks if he's tired, and he responds with, I have clean forgotten in your presence. What a flirt, this guy. He is putting on all the moves, but she's into it.
He's energized by her beauty.
Yeah, she's totally buying this stuff that he's laying down.
Don't you think your gallantry is a little old-fashioned, she said. I mean, I like it. I like everything old-fashioned, and it is delightful to hear you say such pretty things. And she didn't say, I mean, I like it. She just said, I like it. But it's a little bit of a fake-out that she's talking about things being old-fashioned at this time. Yeah. She's got a little bit of awareness that the present is happening, it seems. Just a little bit.
They walk back to her place. It is misty and creepy across the moorlands, and then some hounds run up to them, and the woman, she pets them. She sings a song, one that I won't murder, but the song is called The Hunt, and it was composed in 1821 by Pierre-Jean de Beringer. It translates to hunt, hunt, and hunt again, quit Rosetta and Jonton, tra-la-la, 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 or drive back the game at dawn and let love be the order, tra-la-la, tra-la, tra-la-la.
How did you translate that? Did you just find the translation for it?
Yes.
Somewhere?
I used the delightful annotated King in Yellow by Kenneth Knight.
There you go. That's where you're getting this information from. So it seems like it's just a hunting culture song.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have necessarily gotten that since it's all in French in the story. But yeah, that translation confirms what I thought it was, which is it doesn't really advance the plot too much. It's just to let you know these people are super into hunting. That's what everything's based around.
They get to the house and it's dark outside.
They had to cross a little wooden bridge over a stream and enter the small stone court. So another stone court like last week. And I like that idea that they had to cross a little bridge. It's like crossing a threshold into the medieval world.
When they get to the door, a man gives her a cup and she touches it to her lips and then she lowers it and says, "I bid you welcome." Then there are some strange cup exchanges that go on until she gives Philip a cup and he graciously takes it. And she says, "You are very welcome. Indeed, you are welcome in the Chateau d'Is."
It's kind of like when you go to Hawaii and they give you a lei. This is what they do. They give you a cup, you drink up.
Yeah.
That's the hospitality ritual. And that gets us into the second chapter.
The next day he wakes up and people are getting ready in the courtyard below.
Some kind of horn music woke him up. It's all very medieval out there. He looks out into the court below his room to check out the scene.
It's the woman and others from last night. He listens as they talk in a French-like language, which he knows to be the old language of falconry, which he read about in yellow manuscripts.
There's a little yellow reference there, yeah.
She sends some men out ahead to scout for hunting, and she says, "I do not regret the chase. I will go another time. Courtesy to the stranger, Pelagie, remember?" And a feeble voice came quavering from within the house. "Courtesy." Now, this is straight from Kenneth Haidt's King in Yellow by Arc Dream Publishing, which I'm going to read to you right now. There is this falconry term, which is in French. I'm not going to murder it again, but it means give the bird the courtesy. Allow him to eat some of the kill. And Philip has been hooded and trapped, but should still get the courtesy. So meaning that he somehow stepped into a place and he doesn't know he's the prisoner yet, but we think maybe at this point there's some malevolence going on because it is a spooky story.
Hmm.
And if you knew what that phrase, the courtesy, is a falconry term.
Yeah.
That has got a double meaning to it. Of course, I would never have picked that up in a million years.
Well, they compare him to the captive falcons later in the story.
Yes.
We'll get to that in a second. But I think that's not necessarily malevolent. I mean, isn't it basically saying, don't go on the hunt today. You got to hang around and give him a little taste.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he's not going to be subservient to us if he doesn't get a little something.
Right. And that's still, you know, you're being enslaved. I mean, a hawk is no longer free, or a falcon.
Sure.
So there's a little give and take that goes on there. Well, anyway.
That's love.
That sure is.
Once you surrender to it, you're a bit of a slave. To it.
Philip finds his clothes are gone and replaced with some very antiquated peasant clothing. He assumes his clothes are being washed and these are temporary clothes.
Right. He's clothed like a young huntsman of the Middle Ages. He's got a little cap and shoes with no laces. It's a little like Pulp Fiction after Travolta and Sam Jackson clean up the gore from the guy they've shot and they have to put on crappy shorts and t-shirts that Tarantino's character has lying around. It's very much that. Like, I'd never dress this way. I look like an idiot.
When he leaves the room, he sees an old woman spinning on the distaff. Most people at this time in history would be using a spinning wheel, so this distaff is very antiquated.
There's just lots of evidence that he's actually in a different era. Nobody's surprised by what he's wearing at all.
His lady greets him warmly. He says, "At that same moment, my hostess appeared and returned my salutation with a grace and dignity that sent a thrill to my heart. Her lovely head with its dark curly hair was crowned with a headdress which set all doubts as to the epoch of my own costume at rest. Her slender figure was exquisitely set off by the homespun hunting gown edged with silver, and on her gauntlet-covered wrist she bore one of her petted hawks." He can see his clothes drying in the sun by the garden wall, and he jokes that his clothes seem totally lame compared to these awesome, cool peasant clothes.
He's fitting in with everybody here, but says, these fit great, they're really cool, they're super stylish. If I were to wear them back home, I think I'd get ripped on by everybody. Which he would, right? Because they're very old-fashioned. They don't seem to mind there. But I was thinking at this point in the story, you know, it'd be great if there was a double twist here, because I was pretty sure he had transported himself back in time, but what if he'd actually traveled to the future, but the place he wound up was the Renaissance Fair? That's why the demoiselle has such a strange accent he can't place. It's because she's trying to be all French, but she's actually from, you know, Kenosha, Wisconsin.
There you go.
And can't do the accent quite well.
She says that she's waited to have her breakfast so that he can join her.
We'll be serving overpriced giant turkey legs and flagons of Bud Light Lime. This is the Middle Ages.
Oh, God. Philip keeps blurting out romantic things. I would rather die than forget one word of what you said, which he finds embarrassing, yet he still keeps saying these things.
Yeah, but that was a weird thing, because I get that he's into her, but she hasn't said anything that terribly interesting.
No.
I would rather die than and then forget one glimpse of your gorgeous visage would have been better than this, because all she said was, I'm very hungry.
Yeah.
I'd rather die than forget you say that you're very hungry. And my guess is that if you guys get together and you have a long relationship, you're going to hear I am hungry quite a few more times. In fact, What are we eating tonight is going to become a daily preoccupation of your life.
It sure is.
So you can go ahead and forget that.
Well, fortunately for him, his lines are landing with her and she's just really into him.
And it's become clear to him that he's lovesick. He says, I would give my life to touch with my lips those rosy palms. I understood now that from the moment when I looked into her dark eyes there on the moor last night, I had loved her. My great and sudden passion held me speechless. And that is truly the mystery of love. Just like the proverb at the top, this kind of thing happens. Obviously, an attractive person is an attractive person, symmetrical features. We can all agree on that, but we all also have types.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a mystery. We can try to figure out why we have these types, but it's also kind of a mystery. Why do we long for one person and not another?
There's so much to love. It's not just the way somebody looks, but the way they carry themselves, the way they speak, probably the way they smell, their pheromones, all of those things. It's such a complicated recipe that happens in a human being to figure out why we have a particular taste for one. Who knows? When they sit down and eat, he gets lost in his thoughts and she can see that he's troubled and she asks what's wrong and he's confused by his own feelings. And then he just blurts out, I love you. And she says that she loves him too. And he says, then I shall win you. Win me, she replied.
Yeah.
They just look at each other and are so into one another. It's magic, baby. They finally give each other their names. She is Demoiselle Chandise, which sounds like jaundice, which is when you have yellow skin.
It's an intentional pun. Jaundice. And really one of the only links to King in Yellow, if you can call that a link. It's just sort of a link to the color yellow.
So she tells him that she's an orphan and the men there helped raise her. She never left the moorlands. She's heard of Kersilek, but she's not sure from whom she heard it from. Maybe one of the nursemaids. She's heard also stories about Lupgaru, werewolves.
She heard this from her old nurse, Pelagie, who was actually the person who was saying courtesy earlier.
Yes.
And it made me think maybe this is a village situation at this moment, where this isn't a time-traveling thing. It's just that this is like the Amish or something. It's a town that chose to stay medieval.
Right.
That's way out there in the moors and cut itself off from the modern world. But her nurse also told her about Jean Laflamme, which is a nickname of Joanna of Flanders, and kind of lets you know the era that the nurse is telling tales about. And I'm getting background on Joanna of Flanders from historyofroyalwomen.com. Joanna married John of Montfort in March of 1329, who claimed the title of Duke of Brittany. Now, Brittany allowed for the succession of a woman. John's claim was contested by another Joan, a daughter of Arthur II's second son, Guy, while John was Arthur II's fourth son. Kind of complicated, but basically, Joan had the backing of the King of France, as she was married to his nephew, and so wanted the title, but it was maybe going to go to this other person. So the dispute led to a civil war that lasted 23 years. It was dubbed La Guerre des Deux Joannes for both of the Joans or Joannas involved. So Joanna and John had two children, John and yet another Joan. Her husband died right in the middle of the war while her son was still an infant, and this is when Joanna gets super badass. She personally mustered an army and prepared for battle. Joanna took up arms and dressed in armor while encouraging the townspeople to fight. She spotted the enemy's camp while it was almost unguarded and charged it with 300 men. She burned down its tents and supplies, which earned the nickname The Fiery, which is the nickname that she was given by the nurse, Jeanne La Flamme. Joanna was backed by the English, and while she was forced to flee England, eventually the backing of the English troops helped them capture Charles of Blois, the other Joan's husband, in battle. Though she lived to see her son become John V, Duke of Brittany, Joanna was not well. She became mentally ill and was confined to Tickhill Castle for the rest of her life. It appears she died around 1374, and not much more is known of the illness she suffered. So, the nursemaid told her about werewolves, and she also gave her some good feminist role models who like to burn things down. So, I'm starting to see the attraction here. The old nurse also told her anybody once lost in the unexplored moorland might never return because the moors were enchanted. Demoiselle Dees does not know whether this is true or not, and she had never really thought about about it until she met our protagonist. She's seen ships at sea from the cliffs, but otherwise she has zero knowledge of the outside world. She's never met anybody from anywhere else.
She has this innocent quality that is endearing, and she likes his name, Philip. She insists that he must have French blood within him. He speaks in a very vague way of having to go eventually, but she just won't hear it.
"I do not know what I should do if you never came back," she says.
She flirts with him and gets him to promise to stay the week, and she shows him her different birds and spends some time talking to him about falconry. He sits at her feet enraptured as she explains how to train a falcon. He flirts with her when she says, "First one must catch a falcon." "I am caught," I answered. "I'm already tamed," I replied. "Just and belled." She laughed, delighted. "Oh, my brave falcon, then you will return at my call?" "I am yours," I answered gravely.
Like all good relationships, it starts by being modeled after a captive bird. I don't know. It's trying to be profound there.
She tries to talk falconry, but is caught up with the flirting. She explains that they have to catch the bird, then feed it, but slowly give it less and less food, so it gets hungry. She then gets them to stay on her wrist, and then has meat on a rope and drags it so the bird can catch it. And eventually, she'll swing it around her head, and the bird will catch it out of the air.
After this, it is easy to teach the falcon to strike at game. Always remembering to allow the bird to taste the quarry. So there's that notion again.
All the falcons begin to freak out, and Philip sees that there is a snake, which he thinks is harmless, but she explains it's a viper and deadly.
Only on my second reading did I realize all of the things mentioned in the proverb at the top in the epigraph are in the story.
Yes.
I don't know why I didn't catch that before. She references the ships at sea that she's seen. The falcons are like the eagle in the air. And here we have the snake slithering across a rock.
That's right. It moves onto a big rock and it bathes in the sun. She's worried for Philip because she loves him.
Yeah, he thinks the snake is harmless, and she says, "Oh, no, 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 it's a deadly viper." After she says that, he moves to examine it. Who knows why? But she grabs him.
And they kiss. But when they kiss, he feels a sharp pain on his ankle. He's been bitten by the viper.
Again, kind of a stupid decision to just hang around the viper. They could have moved about 5 feet over and kissed, but, you know.
But when the moment comes, man, you just got to go with it.
That's true. And also, once again, he's made an active decision that's going to lead us into the third act of the story.
Yes. He steps on the viper and crushes its head, but he feels weak and numb, and he falls to the ground. And she holds him, her cheek against his lips, as he passes out. And then we end with this.
When I opened my eyes, I looked around in terror. Jean was gone. I saw the stream and the flat rock. I saw the crushed viper in the grass beside me. But the hawks and blocks had disappeared. I sprang to my feet. The garden, the fruit trees, the drawbridge, and the walled court were gone. I stared stupidly at a heap of crumbling ruins, ivy-covered and gray, through which great trees had pushed their way. I crept forward, dragging my numbed foot, and as I moved, a falcon sailed from the treetops among the ruins, and soaring, mounting in narrowing circles, faded and vanished in the clouds above. "Jean! Jean!" I cried, but my voice died on my lips, and I fell on my knees among the weeds, and as God willed it, not knowing, had fallen kneeling before a crumbling shrine carved in the stone for our Mother of Sorrows. I saw the sad face of the Virgin wrought in the cold stone. I saw the cross and thorns at her feet, and beneath it I read, "Pray for the soul of the Demoiselle Jean Dys, who died in her youth for love of Philip, a stranger, A.D. 1573. But upon the icy slab lay a woman's glove, still warm and fragrant."
And that's the end of the story.
That's it. Right away, I obviously recognize this as a sort of literary treatment of an urban legend that's very popular.
Yeah.
The Phantom Hitchhiker, or the Resurrection Mary legend, as it is in Chicagoland.
Yeah.
A guy meets a girl, they have a great night, then usually he finds out she's been dead a long time when he sees her gravestone, yet there's some element that's left behind, either a jacket or a
Yeah, like she's cold and he gives her his jacket, and then like when he goes back the next day, his jacket's on the gravestone.
Exactly, which is how it was told to me. A guy not that long ago over at the Mexican restaurant I like to eat at after we record told me that story as if it was credibly true. He said it happened in Santa Monica. This guy was, he's in his 60s, and he was like, no, this is real. This really happened. My uncle took a girl out, or he met a girl on the road.
Boy, he said that he was the guy.
No, he didn't say he was the guy. Oh, he knew better. You know, he knew better. This was like his uncle had told it to him, or a cousin right. or something. It's always a friend of a friend or a distant relative. Dropped her off by the cemetery, you know, went to her house the next day. She's been dead for 20 years, and then went into the graveyard, and his jacket was over the gravestone. And I hate to be the guy to tell you this, but that is an old urban legend. Nope, not in this case. That's exactly what happened.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard this being described as a ghost story, but it actually feels more like a time travel story.
Well, either he traveled in time, and yeah. got it. I think that's what it is, because he got it on with her, got bitten by a snake or whatever and died, or he just vanished from her, and that's why she died of grief, right? Because she couldn't figure out what had happened to him.
Yeah.
I think that's likely what happened. If it is a ghost story, then I suppose maybe he is, like in Robert E. Howard, maybe he's a reincarnation of his older self, and he's just reenacting the romance from way back then.
But he's got the woman's gloves, still warm and fragrant.
Yeah, I think it's the former one where he somehow managed to find his way into this medieval village, had a romance, but then was brought back before it could be consummated, and then she died because she was lovesick, and yeah, I think that's what it is.
I like that element of it being kind of just strange, where it's not like specifically, is this a ghost story? Is this a time travel story? It's just odd. It's just weird, unknowable, and it kind of gives that capital W weird feeling to the story.
Yeah, totally. I mean, as much as I get bored with ghost stories and ghost events, you know, being the only thing the story's about, this one was better. It was cool. And I think it also, a story like this sort of appeals to that idea. Like, I was born out of time. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could just go back to a different era, I'm sure I would fall in love and do better.
<You know? laughs> Yeah.
It's that Kate and Leopold kind of thing.
Right.
If I could just go to a medieval village, I'd find a falcon and chick who would understand me. But no pun intended with chick. I did enjoy the story, though. I did. It was really good.
Yeah. Robert Chambers has the goods.
He does, and you could see why this is a story that Lovecraft would have really enjoyed. Speaking of a man out of time. Well, I want to thank our reader once again, Wyatt S. Gray, for bringing the goods. It's two weeks in a row. He's totally rocked it. Love this guy.
He is amazing and talented. Go check him out at wyattcomedy.com.
And don't be afraid to reach out for all your audiobooking needs. I also want to thank our patrons.
Oh my God, do I want to thank them? Yes, I do.
And I'm going to start by thanking Martin Rundqvist. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Kevin Curro.
George Mishriki. Thank you so much.
James Lacey. Thank you.
Oscar Fallen God, I believe is what that says. Fallen God is a great last name. Thank you, Oscar, for being a patron.
Tom McCambly. Thank you so much.
Damon Revelette. Thank you.
James Rose, you are a blessing, sir.
And I want to thank Nick Antonievich.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Ann K.M. Willemsen-Dilks.
Thank you so much, everybody. So glad to have you on the team. I hope you're enjoying our voyage through the King in Yellow. We'll be back next week with more, including guest Kenneth Haidt.
Yay!
So tune in for that. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.